Okay, thank you. If you were at the first one of these, you know that I opened it with a joke about Augustine walking into a bar. And so, since this is the last one of these, I'm going to do, I'll close this one with a joke of René Descartes, the famous French philosopher, walking into the very same bar 1,250 years after Augustine, and sat down and ordered a glass of wine. And when he was about done, the bartender came over and said, "Would you like another?" And he said, "Oh, I think not." Whereupon he disappeared. He was the guy who said, "I think, therefore I am." That was Descartes. So not thinking, he was not. Okay, the last time we've talked, we've traced church history starting at, we started with Constantine, and we moved through some of the other emperors, Theodosius and Justinian. We talked last time about the barbarians and about how they came into the Roman Empire and how they got Christianized. But it was relatively nominal Christianization at that point, because it was just, you know, giving the leader to convert, and therefore, well, all the people converted, but did they really, and how thoroughly were they converted? What did they really know about Christianity? So we're going to take a look at this time at a little bit of how that happened on the ground, so to speak, not just with the leaders, but where the rubber met the road. And we'll look at how the political events turned in the early medieval period through about Charlemagne, and got us sort of vectored towards the direction the church and Christianity was going to take towards the Reformation. People often wonder sometimes about how the church got so corrupt before the Reformation. If you take a course in the Reformation, you find that out. The church was terribly corrupt. But how did it get that way? It didn't start out that way. And this is one of the important vectors in that direction during this period. So the first thing we need to talk about, if we're going to talk about how things got Christianized in the West, is monasticism. Again, we talked about how the rulers got converted, but monasticism was critically important to how Christianity got integrated into people's lives in Western Europe. Let's contrast monasticism in the East and the West. And when I say East, what I'm really talking about is east of the Italian peninsula, in what was called the Roman East, or later the Byzantine Empire. In the East, monasticism was pretty much an ascetic thing. You did have communities of monks who lived together, but they did that mainly for convenience, just so they could eat together. You know, it's hard to have 600 people go find all their own little places, so they would gather together in groups. But they didn't really do anything as a group besides have meals and maybe some prayers. Their life was contemplation and reading scripture and praying and leading this ascetic life. And they really didn't do a lot of what we would call work, okay, the way monks did in the West. To contrast that, in the West you had, especially after the 6th century, you had the rule of Benedict. Benedict of Nursia was a monk who wrote a rule that was taken up by all the Western monasteries, and they became Benedictine. They were really the only game in town until about the 11th century, when the Dominicans and some of these other orders came into being. But with the rule of Benedict, monasticism was a community thing. It was a community activity. People were expected to work. They were expected to be self-sufficient. And they were under authority. You had to get along with your brother monks, and you had to respect the authority of the abbot, and the abbot had authority over him. So it was a real Christian community that worked hard, did a lot of agriculture work, and they became pretty prosperous when they did this, usually. So that was how monasticism was in the West, and so it was sort of more open to interacting with people. Not only could you be a monk who took the regular vows of poverty and chastity, but they had what they called lay brothers, taking less severe oaths than that. The people from the surrounding area could work with the monastery, and they would, I mean, it wasn't a bad deal. You got 3 squares a day. You got, if you were a Benedictine, you got a mug of wine every day too. That was part of the deal with in the Benedictine monasteries. If you got sick, they took care of you. So in that way, people from the surrounding areas were also sort of brought into the monastic structure. Monasticism attracted many followers as a way to demonstrate one's devotion to God and the church. It was also the only way that women could serve the church. Monks were much more literate than the population as a whole, and at each monastery there was normally a group of monks that were highly literate and were involved in making manuscripts. In order to keep their Latin skills honed, monks kept manuscripts of eloquent Roman writers like Cicero and Virgil and Seneca. They would keep copying them and study them so they could understand and keep their Latin skills up. They also kept manuscripts from the church fathers, people like Irenaeus and Tertullian and people like that. Without them, the few ancient Western works that we have left probably would not have been preserved. Many of the barbarians were already Christianized when they entered Western Europe. We talked about that last time. So monasteries tended to be spared from pillaging. Not always, but much more frequently than towns, monasteries were left alone. So as the Roman Empire crumbled in the West, many of the functions of society that required learning migrated to monasteries, including education. Barbarians settling in Western Europe used monks to assist in administration, writing laws, for example. You've got to remember, these people admired the Romans. The barbarians who were coming in wanted to be like the Romans. They knew that laws were important. They knew that administration was important. They knew they needed not only literacy. They were sort of semi-literate in the 4th and 5th and 6th centuries, but they needed fluency. So monks and the church in general became indispensable partners of these new rulers in Western Europe. And it's through that contact that the general populace was exposed to Christianity, and that really got sort of worked in through monasteries, much more than through cathedrals and churches. As those became more common, that became a more common method, but early on, it was the monasteries. Okay, let's take a look now at the church and the focus of the church as we move from late antiquity, from the time of Augustine and so, into the early medieval period. As the Western Empire crumbled in the 5th century, the church naturally shifted its focus towards the emperors in Constantinople. They were no longer in Rome, and they, starting with Constantine, they were sort of sometimes in Rome and sometimes not, and then after Theodosius, they were always in Constantinople. This shift was strengthened by Justinian, who died in about the middle of the 6th century. We talked about him not last time, but the time before. And he was a very strong Christian emperor, and he pulled that focus even more toward the east during his reign. And although the Byzantine Empire lost control of Italy as a whole to the Lombards, Rome remained under Byzantine control. Italy, we talked about this before, ironically, Italy that was so firmly under the control of the Romans, into the early medieval time got chopped up and stayed chopped up for 1,000 years. Rome itself stayed under Byzantine control for quite a long time. Most popes during some of the early medieval period were Eastern. For example, from 678 to 752, there were 13 popes. 11 of them were either Greek or Syrian. That's a fairly big change from what had come before, where they were mostly Western men. Now they're, because of the shift to the East, they're mostly Eastern men. Choosing popes, a pope in those days was a two-step process. Election, followed by consecration. If you know anything about medieval history, you know that the election is important, but the consecration part is really important. That's where a lot of the controversy started in medieval history, with whether a consecration was valid or not. These were both done in the early medieval period by Italian nobles and bishops. There was no cardinals. The College of Cardinals did not come into existence until 1054, about the same time as the split between the Orthodox and the Western churches. However, when Justinian freed the Italian peninsula from control of the Ostrogoths in about 545, he demanded and got the power to veto a papal consecration. So he could veto the selection of a pope, essentially. So now the emperor in Constantinople has control over who can be pope. They put somebody in he doesn't like, he says, not that guy. The papacy rather reluctantly went along with this because of the ongoing protection that the Byzantines gave them from the Lombards. Here comes the politics. Okay? This is an issue, and it's going to stay an issue. In the 8th century, the Byzantines had their hands full with the Arabs. If you remember, after Muhammad died in 632, the Arabs came bursting out of the Saudi Arabian Peninsula and started taking things over wholesale and quickly. That became a real issue for the Byzantines, and they were fighting the Arabs for essentially forever after that. At that time, though, the conflict was rather hot in the 8th century, and the emperor had to raise taxes to assist in fighting against the Arabs. Okay, so he's taxing now the people in the West and the Romans. And the Pope refused to pay those taxes. There was also an ongoing controversy between the East and West in the 8th century that's called the Iconoclasm Controversy, about the use of icons in worship. The emperor forbade the use of icons in the church, ostensibly because he said icons made it more difficult for them to convert Muslims and Jews. The Pope went into a full revolt about this. Well, why? In the West, they used icons. They called them the poor, the peasant's Bible, because the peasants were all illiterate, yet they'd come to church and they'd see these icons and these scenes from biblical history around the church, and they felt that that was important for people to be able to relate to biblical history that way. So, with the emperor forbidding icons, the Pope goes into full revolt, breaks ties with Constantinople, and revoked the emperor's right to veto papal consecration. However, what about the protection racket? Okay, now the emperor's not going to protect Rome anymore, and the Pope needs protection from the Lombards, which he finally got from the Carolingian Franks. As we talked about, the Franks were people who moved into Western Europe, who became Christianized, and they were the ones who ultimately took over the whole show there. The Pope from this point forward would be strongly tied to the West and almost completely disconnected from the East. And again, that started in about the middle of the 8th century. That eventually is going to result in the split 400 years, 300 years later. between the Roman Catholic and the Eastern Orthodox churches, which happened in 1054. So the church did flop to the east when the Western Empire dissolved, but eventually a few hundred years later, it split, and now we're back. The churches in Rome are firmly oriented toward the west, and they're really ignoring what's going on in Constantinople, pretty much. Okay, let's go back and talk about the Franks now. When last we left the Franks, they had converted to Nicene Christianity, which is Orthodox Christianity. Most of the other barbarians were Arian Christians. In other words, they believed that Christ was a created being. But not the Franks. They were Orthodox Christians, at least nominally, because their leader was. They were expanding in what is now France under their leader, who was Clovis, who was a contemporary with the Emperor Justinian. In the 8th century, they were ruled by Clovis's successors, which was called the Merovingian dynasty. Merovingian, Carolingian, you don't really need to memorize those words. They're all Franks. They're just different dynastic families, all part of the Franks. A Frankish civil war in the early 8th century allowed Charles Martel from another family known as the Carolingians to take control of the Franks in 719. Charles drove out the Arabs who were creeping into southern France from Spain in the Battle of Tours in 732. Historically, that's a really important point. And humanly speaking, if he wouldn't have done that, we'd have probably all walked in here with prayer rungs under our arm tonight, because the Arabs had up until that time, for 100 years, from 632 to 732, been completely unstoppable. And Charles Martel finally stopped them in southern France. After Charles died in 741, he was succeeded by his son Pepin the Short. Pepin had a problem in that there was still a Merovingian claimant to the throne around, and he was a Carolingian family guy. So in 750, he proposed a pact to the Pope. If the Pope would bless the deposing of this last Merovingian king, Pepin would take on the Lombards for him. Another political deal, okay? Why did he go to the Pope? Answer, Pope is the next most important guy in all of Europe, easily. So he goes to him to get a blessing for doing this. Pope said, yes, if you take care of my Lombard problem for me, and the deal is done. That last Merovingian king was consigned to a monastery, which is a pretty soft landing, especially for those days, while Pepin journeyed south of the Alps to attack the Lombards in 755. The Lombards were forced to back off their pressure of the Pope and return some property to the church. They remained in northern Italy. Pepin couldn't completely drive them out. When Pepin died in 768, the kingdom was taken over by his son Charlemagne, which is, that name is from Charles Lemagne in Old French, which means Charles the Great. Charlemagne was the greatest Carolingian ruler, and he is sometimes called the father of Europe. He was a devout Catholic, and he had a long rule from 768 to 814. During his reign, he greatly expanded the Frankish kingdom. If you remember, the old Roman kingdom had border on the Rhine River, which is in the western part of what is now Germany, pretty close to the border between Germany and France, and along the border north-south ran along the Danube, which started north of the Alps and ended up in the Black Sea. So Charlemagne he crossed the Rhine and went all the way to the Elbe River. They did everything by rivers in those days. The Elbe is almost on the eastern border of what is now Germany. As part of this expansion, he conquered the Saxons east of the Rhine. They were a pretty tough nut to crack. He imposed Christianity on them. his program, Charlemagne's program for Christianization, went like this. You baptize first, then you send in missionaries to explain to the people what they had just become a part of. Two events occurred under Charlemagne that had profound consequences for the future course of Western civilization and the church. His crowning as Holy Roman Emperor and the Carolingian Renaissance. The crowning of Charlemagne as Holy Roman Empire is one of the most shocking and outrageous events that occurred in medieval Europe. And here's how it came about. When Leo III was elevated to Pope in 795, the relatives of the previous Pope were unhappy that the papacy did not stay in their family. So they hatched a plot to accuse Leo III of immorality, and he probably was guilty of it. They also kidnapped him. Leo III managed to escape, but he needed a powerful friend, so he headed to Charlemagne's court, which was in Aachen, in what is now the northwest corner of Germany. Standing by Leo III made a lot of sense for Charlemagne, because if that was successful, he then had the Pope on his side and very much in his debt. So Charlemagne travels to Rome and sets up a commission to look into the matter. The commission wasn't dumb. They never brought any charges, and they turned over all their evidence to Charlemagne and resigned. They were not about to take a stand on this issue that could have been fatal, depending on which way. So they just got all their evidence together and said to Charlemagne, okay, this is your baby now. One way to establish your innocence in that time was to have a powerful patron publicly accept your oath of innocence. So Charlemagne said that he would allow Leo III to clear himself with an oath. Charlemagne came to Rome, and on December 23 of the year 800, Leo III publicly took the oath of innocence, which was accepted by Charlemagne, and Leo's problems came to an end, in no small part, because Charlemagne was the most powerful man in Europe. 2 days later, on Christmas Day 800, at Mass, when Charlemagne knelt at the altar to pray, Leo III crowned him Imperator Romanorum, Emperor of the Romans. Charlemagne later claimed this was a surprise, but that's widely disbelieved. They had to have this all worked out ahead of time. Now, never mind that the Western Empire had crumbled and the last Western Emperor had been deposed 325 years earlier, and also never mind that the Pope had never had anything to do with the crowning of previous Roman emperors. Leo III and Charlemagne were on a roll, and they were making this up as they went, and they hatched this one, and it was interesting. Except for a 40-year dormancy in the 10th century, the title of Holy Roman Emperor would last for another 1,000 years. And the soon-to-be-formed Holy Roman Empire of land that is mostly now Germany, which wasn't even in the original empire, would go along with it. I don't like to quote Voltaire very often because he was a sort of a smart-aleck anti-Christian guy. But he said that the Holy Roman Empire was neither holy, nor Roman, nor an empire. Okay, and he was right. He was right about this one. The existence of the Holy Roman Empire and the mutual binding of the Pope and the Holy Roman Empire would have a deep impact on the future of the West. This stuff was still a really important consideration in what was going on in the Reformation, and for another 100-plus years after that. The jockeying between Charles V, who was the Holy Roman Empire at the time of Luther, and Luther, and the King of France, Francis I, and the Popes, turned out to have critical impacts on how the Reformation went. So this stuff had echoes that just went on and on and on. Okay, the Carolingian Renaissance. Charlemagne became aware that many texts, like the Rule of Benedict, the writings of the Church Fathers, in common use, had become garbled because of problems introduced by many copyings. Again, we're using manuscripts, right? It's not 1453, 1500 yet. We're not printing anything. Everything's got to be copied by hand. When you copy stuff by hand, errors get introduced. There were many different forms of the Vulgate Bible were in use at that point, copied from different exemplars, and they were sometimes quite different. If you remember, the Vulgate was the Bible that was translated by Jerome in the 5th century. A marvelous piece of work. Jerome was a linguistic genius. Didn't use the Septuagint for the Old Testament, he used the Hebrew Scriptures for the Old Testament. He was expert in Hebrew and Greek and Latin. And he used the best Greek manuscripts he could get a hold of for the New Testament, and he translated the Vulgate, which was the Church's standard Bible for well over 1,000 years. But again, the Vulgate still got to be copied, so they had copies of copies of copies of copies of copies, and it was getting garbled because of all this copying. Also by this point, the pronunciation of the Latin language had begun to evolve into the Romance languages, Portuguese, Spanish, French, and Italian, and Romanian, but they're not much of a consideration for Western Europe. Charlemagne also noticed that when monks came to them from, say, the British Isles, they spoke Latin quite differently. And he came to find out they spoke it more correctly. Charlemagne was very worried. Remember, this guy was a really strong Catholic, and he thought about the religious implications of everything all the time. He was very worried about the combination of bad Latin pronunciation and bad texts. With bad texts, you can't know for sure what Scripture is requiring you to do or imploring you to believe. Okay, fair enough on that one, but to Charlemagne, bad pronunciation meant that God could not understand your prayers or sacraments. Divine omniscience was not a concept he grasped very well. As an example, while doing field research to find out what Latin pronunciation was like out in the parishes, Charlemagne's investigators found a priest who, instead of baptizing in nomine, in the name of, Patris, the Father, et Filii, and the Son, they didn't use the Holy Spirit yet in their formulations at that time, he was baptizing, using this phrase, in nomine, in the name of, Patria, et filia. He put us on the end of both of those words. To the extent that makes sense in Latin, it means in the name of the fatherland and the daughter. There was real concern when this was discovered that perhaps this priest, and presumably many others, had sent scores of people to hell because their baptisms were invalid. Okay? This is a thinking in those days. It's a much more superstitious kind of approach. If you don't get baptized right, there's no chance of you being saved. Okay? Charlemagne feared that this problem put all people in grave peril. Thus, he determined that it was absolutely vital that texts be corrected and Latin, especially for the clergy, be brought back up to standard. This was the genesis of the Carolingian Renaissance. Charlemagne was able to attract scholars from all over Europe, including Britain, to assist in this endeavor. The leader was one of the finest scholars in the West, Alcuin of York. All the scholars were clerics or would become clerics during their work. New editions of important Christian documents, especially Scripture, were produced. And this was arduous work. They scoured libraries and monasteries all over Europe to get existing versions to compare and contrast. Alcuin himself cleaned up the Vulgate version of the Bible. Once a new clean text was ready, it had to be copied over many times and sent out to purge the continent of older garbled texts. Book production soared. It is estimated that 50,000 copies of books were produced in the 9th century alone, which is a huge number to copy by hand. Spelling had also become quite chaotic, and Charlemagne had that standardized too, along with pronunciation. As the scholars had to use classical works of literature like Cicero and Virgil and Seneca to get their Latin up to speed, a side effect of the Carolingian Renaissance was increased attention to these works and transmission of them to future generations. Indeed, many modern scholars believe that we have the few ancient Western texts that we do only because of the Carolingian Renaissance. Charlemagne in 1789 ordered that every monastery and every bishop should establish a school. This education was to be offered to everyone, which was a new concept, probably the first time in the world, but certainly the first time in the West, that the concept of universal education was floated. Now this definitely did not come to pass everywhere. In fact, probably in the majority of places, it didn't actually come to pass that way. And most of the peasant class did not take advantage where it was offered. But it was a start. Most of the effects of the Carolingian Renaissance were on the clergy. And as you went up the ladder in the clergy, the effects were stronger. A big effect of the Carolingian Renaissance is seen by us every time we look at a printed page. The Carolingians realized that a big part of the copying problem was with the way texts were written. Ancient texts generally had no spaces between the words and were all in a single case and had no punctuation. So as a sea of letters, they were very difficult to read. If you've ever looked at, go online and look at some Roman inscriptions. It's a huge block of letters all jammed together. Yeah, there might, if you're lucky, there might be one space or two. It's, you know, how do you read this stuff? It's hard. Also, various types of handwriting had emerged in various places. So they decided it was time for some standardization, and they revolutionized the way texts were written by doing all of these things, adding space between all words, starting each sentence with a capital letter, and using smalls elsewhere, adding punctuation, inventing a new font called Carolingian Minuscule, which was compact, beautiful, and clear. What we use today, and what I say what we use today, it's, you know, go into a classroom somewhere, first or second grade, and look at the way they have the letters put up for kids to print. That's pretty close to what Carolingian Minuscule was. The effect of the Carolingian Renaissance was huge, especially on preserving ancient documents and transmitting all documents to the future with fewer errors. These numbers I'm going to quote came from the head of the history department at Notre Dame, but I still have a hard time believing this small number. He said there are fewer than 200 Western books which survive from before 800 AD. That number seems impossibly small to me, because probably if we sat here, we could name maybe half of those. At any rate, the number of books that were transmitted to the West from before 800 AD is really tiny. I don't, if it's 400 or 500 or 1,000, it's almost nothing compared to what was actually produced back then. In contrast, there's over 6,000 books that survived just from the 9th century alone. Okay, so right there at the Carolingian Renaissance, the difference is just night and day. However, by trying to rescue the Latin language, they ended up murdering it. They saw the process of Latin evolving into the Romance languages as one of decay. There was no way the local precursors of the Romance languages were going to go away, because so many people spoke them out in the hinterlands where they didn't listen to what they were saying up there in Aachen. But now there's a huge gap between the local vernacular languages and this new revitalized Latin. And the populace saw the revitalized Latin as the language of the educated elite. So the Romance languages were further entrenched as languages of the populace, and Latin became cut off as a language of just the clergy and the educated. And that is where I'm complete. Any questions?
When you say Latin was murdered, you mean just that it was no longer used?
Right. It was murdered for the common people. But probably unavoidable anyway. But that was a point at which, you know, the split really became noticeable. And Latin went on in its now revitalized format and went on until the 19th and even into the 20th century in some places where they still taught. A lot of monks were still taught in Latin in the 20th century.
How long did the Holy Roman Empire continue?
Till Napoleon ended it in 1806, I think. Yeah. Unbelievable anachronism that stuck around for 1,000 years. Yeah, Bruce.
You referred to Charlemagne several times as Catholic.
Use that term. Yeah. That's to distinguish him from being Arian. Usually, to me, it's this. In those days, it's the same thing to say Orthodox Christian as Catholic Christian as Nicene Christian. Those terms are used somewhat interchangeably. But it's all as opposed to being an Arian, or in the East, a Monophysite or an Nestorian or something. All of those are heretical positions as opposed to the Orthodox Nicene position. Yes? Sander.
So, would they just cut Latin like that, or would it taper off?
That's a great question. I don't think there was any authority around to cut it off. I'd have to guess that it just tapered off and continued to evolve into the Romance languages down there in the hinterlands and the backwaters. Yeah. Yes, Sandra. I think you could really make that case because, for instance, the Vulgate is a really important source to a scriptural source for us. Not that people use it for any kind of modern translations, but biblical scholars use it a lot, and a really good Vulgate is a great source to them because you know, Jerome did it way back in the late 4th, early 5th centuries. So you need to have that Latin, right, available to you to be able to translate that. That would be one example of the good
of it.
Right. Right. And it probably stabilizes it a lot too, because it's now it's not being used.
Right. So we can all learn it.
In vernacular.
So there's a way in which we can talk. There's a way in which, since it ossifies, everybody learns exactly the same system.
Right. Yeah, Nelson.
So Charlemagne brought these scholars together to clean up Bible.
The Vulgate.
Were they good? I mean, did they get back to Jerome's?
Well, that's a great question. I mean, I don't know that there's any way to know that. They did the best job that they could, and Alcuin was the guy that did that. He was one of the best people you could have picked in all of Europe to do it. I'm guessing he did as good a job as anybody could. Now, of course, now, I mean, the situation for us now is a little bit different because in the 17th, and especially 18th and 19th centuries, there was a big search put on for manuscripts all over Europe and the Middle East. And they found a lot of them, too. That's a whole interesting story in and of itself. But we have much better and older Greek sources now than they had for a very, very long time. We don't know what Greek sources Jerome was using. Obviously, they were contemporary with him. But, for instance, the Codex, what's called the Codex Sinaiticus, came from a monastery on Mount Sinai, was found by a guy named Count Tischendorf in the middle of the 19th century. And it is a complete New Testament from the 4th century. And they believe it's one. Constantine, when he became a Christian, had 50 copies made of New Testaments, 50 manuscript copies, really nice ones, that got distributed all over Europe. They think that's one of those 50, okay? And it's the oldest complete New Testament in Greek that we have. There are partial pieces that are older. But that's, you know, that was maybe 75 plus, maybe 75 years before Jerome even started his work. So we're in an even better position today with the critical Greek texts that we have, than maybe even Jerome was possibly back in his day. Yeah, Bruce.
You said that this set the course for the decline in the morals of the church up through the Reformation.
Mm-hmm.
Could you expand on that a bit?
Sure. Well, getting the Pope, the first leg in that journey was going from the church as it was in the second, third centuries to the imperial church, the Constantinian church, having Constantine say, oh, Christian is the way to go. The empire is now a Christian place. It took maybe 75 years to get that all worked out, but that's a change in direction. And a lot of people think it wasn't a very good change in direction. Stan and I have had some discussions about that. So the church became now an imperial church and gained a lot of power. And that brought a lot of changes into the church. And, you know, some of them were good, that people did get persecuted, but political power is never a good thing for the church to have. It's not part of, lose sight of our mission, right? So that was one in that path. And now we come to Charlemagne, where now the Holy Roman Empire and the Pope are tied together politically by giving each other, you know, by this sort of mutual admiration society. I'll consecrate you and if you consecrate me, kind of a thing. That obviously has bad implications, and now people wanted to use that for all kinds of, and it got used that way for all kinds of political purposes as things went forward. And, you know, Pope started fighting wars. I mean, they didn't have armies of people. There was a place called the Papal States in Italy. They didn't raise armies from their own people, but they got mercenary armies together that they paid for, and they were a player in the wars in medieval Europe. Isn't it blessed are the peacemakers? I thought. Not blessed are the churches who actually go and fight wars. That's an example, you know, of the kinds of things that happen, I believe, because of, as a traceable result of this kind of catching up of the church in politics. Yes?
No. Crusades occurred at what time?
Crusades started toward the end of the 11th century and lasted for about 200 years. What can you say? There's obviously a huge hunk of history in there and a lot of things to be said, but started out as with an idea of getting the Holy Land back from the Muslims. Went wrong almost from the get-go when the first group of people, not of knights. The knights, the first group of ordinary people who were coming on the Crusades decided that they would take out some Jews at the same time in Europe. Might as well, right? We're on our way to kill some infidels. Might as well kill some infidels before we get to the Middle East. Lots of bad stuff happened in the Crusades, I'm afraid.
Take that, it just seems like a lot of that goes back to Constantine and the sort of combination of church and political power, and that really was a, and that whole mindset of, like you mentioned earlier, right, we'll baptize them first, and or this kind of expansion of the church via coercion and force and armies marching, and I mean that's just been such a poisonous compromise of the witness of the church for centuries.
Yes, it has. And you can see small things happen, for instance, not long after that. It used to be when they would take communion, the Eucharist, they gathered together in these church houses in the second, third centuries, and it was sort of a simple meal that they would share with each other. Well, in the imperial church, it became more and more, it got some pagan stuff sort of put on top of it because it came more and more like a sacrifice, okay? And here we have the beginnings of this, the issue about what is taking of the Lord's Supper, okay? And the now Roman Catholic understanding of it versus what our understanding would be. So it got to be, this elaborate thing where the people were sort of just sitting back, not doing much. And the priests were sort of doing this thing, and it became almost like a sacrifice, sort of taking the place of what had gone on in the pagan temples was now something that was Christian, but Christianity being modified by what was going on because of the imperial church. Yeah, I agree. That was a lurch in a bad direction.
You would have learned from our mistakes.
Yeah, sure would. Anything else? Yeah, Bruce.
The quote about texts.
Yep.
Before 800.
Was again what this what Heard said was that. From before 800, only 200 books. And you got to do that in quotes because there really isn't a book before that. There's a codex or a scroll. Survive from the West.
Okay.
That's the number that seems impossibly small to me.
Did a lot of things came west after the fall of Constantinople. Then you had the Arabs. Translations of some of the ancient Greeks, maybe some of the texts that you're familiar with have a different.
Yeah, maybe they're not counted in that number, but it is whatever that number is. It's a tiny number compared to what was available back then. Yeah. Anything else? Okay. Thank you.